you know, you're talking about an unknown unknown, right? So they don't even have a framework for how to think about this stuff most of the time. And so here you are coming in saying, let's talk about this. And that can be very off-putting and very make someone very defensive naturally, right? The other piece of it is you're really having people confront their mortality. And that's equally, if not more, disturbing to somebody who's not prepared for it.
Welcome to Now or Never, Long-Term Care Strategy with Costa Yepafonsev, a podcast for all those seeking answers and solutions in the long-term care space. This podcast is designed to create resources, start conversations, and bring awareness to the industry that will inevitably impact all Americans. Here's your host, Costa Yepafonsev.
Hey, y'all, it's Costa. Today, I'm here with my guest, Maxwell Schmidt. Certified long-term care specialist, senior advisor, CEO of YetWorth, and author of Planting the Seed, 20 Ways to Preserve Your YetWorth. Today, we're talking about who actually needs long-term care insurance. Max, it's an honor to have you on the show with us. Let's start with the basics. What is long-term care insurance, and how is it most commonly used?
I mean, simple question, but also kind of what a loaded question, right? I mean, long-term care insurance, that's like six syllables with some pretty charged up words, right? Yeah, people really get stuck on it just based on their preconceived notions, whether it's true or invented. It means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. But out of those six syllables, there's really one that sticks out the most to me, and that's the word care. These are ultimately benefits that pay for care, more accurately, care expenses, but start by zooming out, right? It's for that care. And yes, of course, there's, you know, important policy language and benefit structures and eligibility triggers and all that good stuff. But you got the 30,000 foot view here being that care aspect. So let's define that a little bit more. Care is not companionship. And that's what a lot of people end up believing. Unfortunately, we think of all the cuddly stuff like, oh, I've got to be there to support my spouse or what have you. And support is obviously absolutely important in these conditions. But, you know, I'm just thinking about the actual nitty-gritty stuff. You know, I've got three kids, 6, 4, and 2. And yes, while companionship and cuddles are all part of that equation, I think it helps thinking about that stuff because it gets really dirty. You have to imagine all the stuff that you got to deal with as we get older, right? So because we tend to revert. So it's a big cycle. If you picture like a circle and you start at the bottom, 6 o'clock, and you go up to noon, the top of the circle, which is like the time in which you're most healthy, most independent, most capable. Everybody comes back down. That's just the natural life cycle. But you can think of it more of like a health cycle. So in fact, just before COVID, I took a tour of this place called the Buck Institute for Research in Aging, and they explained the difference, like a lifespan and a health span. And so the average lifespan at the time was about 82. The average health span was 69. So that's a 13-year delta. And their mission is to close that gap by increasing health spans, not reducing lifespans. Yeah. And they probably don't want me to say this, but they're still a long way off. So that means we've got some work to do, right? Because historically, this is the space where long-term care comes in to help people with their ADLs, like we were managing for children, the bathing, the dressing, the continence, the toileting. Transferring all that and all the instrumental activities that come with that too, right? So it's, you know, the laundry, the preparing the meals, et cetera. So,
and I think it's important. I think it's important to also point out that there are some disabilities like Alzheimer's that have, you know, symptoms such as dementia where you are maybe physically there, but you can't, you know, you might forget where you are and have to find your way back home. You have like forgetfulness. I mean, just the fact that you may not be able to stay at home by yourself, you know, is a huge barrier for a lot of people to be able to have some freedom and stability as a caregiver in their lives. And even though I know in the form of companionship, it may not be exactly what we're talking about, but having somebody that's skilled and specialized to be able to provide those wraparound supports, I think is a really important component to bring to the table so that those types of bad things, those life-threatening things don't happen. So right. And that's an expensive proposition too.
Exactly. Oh my gosh. And I mean, to your point though, jumping back to the supervision required during a care or cognitive disability scenario, you know, I was just talking to an advisor who was asking if it's maybe time to open up a claim for his client because what was going on is, you know, he was the client was an electrician for 40 years. And so he was having some issues back at home. His wife called him, called the advisor saying, hey, you know, he started a couple fires playing around with the electrical box. Do you think it's time that we can start using this long-term care policy? He can still do everything else. It's like, you should have called yesterday. That's a problem for everybody's safety. And, you know, we need to make sure that he's supervised so that everybody can continue to live as much of a normal life as possible.
We know that about 70% of people will need long-term care sometime in their life. So why don't 70% of people have long-term care insurance?
Oh, man. Another loaded question, right? I mean, it's hard to answer that without really pointing fingers, it feels like, in some way.
That's okay.
You know, someone or some part of society is like probably at fault, right? So I'll just do this and point the finger right back at myself. I mean, I'll take the fall for this one collectively. Okay. Just on behalf of insurance brokers and financial advisors, pretty much. That's what it comes down to. And it, you know, it's kind of been a contentious fight between those two facets of the industry, those two pockets in insurance brokers and financial advisors. There's kind of a silent or maybe not so silent, you know, I won't call it a war necessarily, but there's strong opinions on either side about the best way to deliver certain pieces of advice, which model is better for people, et cetera. And unfortunately, through all that noise, our clients are the ones who are getting completely overlooked. So, I mean, listen, I just saw a study conducted by a carrier that indicated 45% of financial advisors don't even consider long-term care insurance in their planning. And before insurance planners start salivating on that number, I bet it's even less among insurance brokers. So, you know, and many have told me as much too, right? That I'll never forget early in my career, I called on this big time advisor I knew very well through my local NAFA chapter. He told me point blank, if I do my job, then my clients never need long-term care insurance. And you know what? I actually believed him for a long time, an embarrassingly long time. It was about, I would say maybe 6-7 years ago when I decided to actually crunch the numbers against this, you know, self-fund versus insured debate. And realized that the premium people were paying on the back end far exceeded the premium on the front. So simply put, if you tally the average cost of care today, and for a high net worth client that this guy's talking about, we're talking $10,000 to $15,000 a month, home care or residential, doesn't matter.
Right.
It's $10,000 to $15,000 for a high level of service, which is what these clients come to expect.
And so, quality outcomes, quality of care, all that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you're gonna eat through $120,000 a year minimum, if you have that average claim scenario of 3 to 4 years, you're looking at somewhere between $360,000 to $720,000, and that's after taxes. So call it $500,000 to $1,000,000 from a taxable account. And that's not even the worst case scenario by far, as we know. So, well,
I mean, you put pen to paper and it makes sense for you and you're in the industry. Why don't more people just put pen to paper and figure it out?
I think it comes down to a few things, right? You've got some obstacles in the way. And I think it's really more emotional than anything else. I see it as two core issues that you're going to see some defensiveness in a client. A is the fact that, you know, you're talking about an unknown, right? So they don't even have a framework for how to think about this stuff most of the time. And so here you are, coming in saying, let's talk about this. And that can be very off-putting and very make someone very defensive naturally, right? The other piece of it is you're really having people confront their mortality. And that's equally, if not more, disturbing to somebody who's not prepared for it. So there's methods and ways in which you can gently approach this stuff. You know, if you're bringing an illustration to that first meeting, you're gonna lose a client probably. And I think that's where a lot of people are coming from, or they think that this is gonna happen to them as an advisor. If you're sitting in this position, I'm not gonna talk about long-term care. They don't wanna talk about it. I don't wanna talk about it. Nobody wants to talk about it.
Cause it's like a deal killer?
It could be, if that's kind of their MO, I guess. But
sure. But
it could be more, I think the more of a root issue here would be like a relationship killer. You know, we're very much in the relationship business. If you bring in something off-putting like that, That's not the normal investment strategy we're talking about in our quarterly meetings or what have you. So this is just kind of feels like it's out of left field because you never laid the groundwork for this discussion. And I think that's really what we're missing here is people, advisors, insurance brokers are not laying the adequate groundwork to really have a more informed discussion about it. So I'm all about just planting the seeds early, saying, you know, something on the roadmap that we need to talk about at some point down the road is, you know, the care experience. And we have a really good method and process for coming up with a needs analysis for you and identifying what your options are, whether it's through another specialist or whatever it may be, and just identifying that as part of the normal process without jumping straight into it, you know, cold like that. So that
let's talk about let's talk about premium. So on average, how much is a monthly or an annual premium for a long-term care policy, and how does the price of long-term care insurance change with age, and typically what impacts it the most?
Yeah, so it varies so much, and I know that's a cop-out, but it is the truth. Okay. I mean, it really depends. So
you're going to have to give us a range at some
point. I'll get there. How about right now? So I always like to show a $200 option, no matter what, you know, no matter how small it is, you know, showing that $200 a month option per individual is usually going to at least be, if it's not a plan design that people go for, it'll be a great starting point for the conversation. I think 200, that just seems to be, the data indicates that's been about the average premium for a long time. I think it's crept up a little bit more in recent years, but even to within 5 years ago, I want to say the running average for the last 15 years before that was about $200 a month. So I just have that in the back of my mind as kind of an anchor point for the discussion. And then we'll talk about what the actual needs are as well, because, you know, I alluded to something that was kind of a loaded term as well, which was the premium on the back end. So if you're really running the numbers and you're putting pen to paper, you're talking about, you know, a scenario where you could lose about $1 million, which would result, if you're using the 4% rule, that would be about $40,000 of income lost from the income asset that $1 million would produce every year thereafter. And while that doesn't sound like a big deal to the person undergoing the care scenario, you know, what you're doing is you're setting up a surviving spouse for a really tough situation financially. And so, you know, if it's somebody who has $10 million and they're missing, you know, and they're making that $400,000 or whatever using the 4% rule, that is less of a chunk, but it still could be the difference between, you know, that second home or whatever the situation may be at that point. So just take into account that all those assets are already allocated. Okay. So I was talking to somebody with $15 million net worth, a client who applied and was approved recently. And he was, you know, I asked him about the self-insurance concept, and he straight up said point blank, he's like, that means we would have to liquidate something. And that is not something I'm prepared to do with my family and our goals. We love the lifestyle we live now, and I don't want to take any of that apart to pay for a long-term care scenario. And this is somebody with $15 million. So your client with $5 million probably could operate off of the same program there. So just something more to think about on the back end premium.
On average, though, I mean, people save roughly about $300,000 for retirement. You know, they don't save $1 million to five to 10 to 15. That is, there are people that do that, obviously, as you know, but that's a very small percentage. Call it maybe 10% of the U.S. population. And I know I'm being gracious there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, I think you are. But yeah,
but like if somebody's only saving $300,000 for retirement and they want to preserve at least something in terms of generational wealth to pass on to their families, why would they not buy long-term care insurance and spend $200 a month? Like, is the cost of the premium, can it be just ridiculously unaffordable? And if that is the case, what type of health outcomes contribute to that unaffordability?
Yeah, you can definitely see it tick up from the premium from a health perspective.
Okay.
You know, it's one of those things, though, that I think more often you'd see a decline from the carriers these days. And that's where, you know, we haven't even dived into this yet. But, you know, you're probably looking at, based on financial or health outcomes, only half of people really being even eligible for long-term care insurance.
I see.
And I think more of that half need to be aware that this is an opportunity and not some sort of cost that they're going to have to negotiate at some point. Like, you are one of the lucky ones if you are financially or health savvy enough to yeah. or, you know, well enough to be able to qualify for these policies. So, you know, we kind of look at it at this, as this gray cloud of insurance planning that, you know, you want to, you don't want to have to deal with. Maybe you just want to get it over with, but it's really a cool opportunity for people to throw their chips in and say, you know what, I'm going to spread this risk out with, you know, maybe 12 to 100 million of my best friends, to sure. shoulder the burden together.
There you go. Do you think that long-term care insurance should be required in the United States? like car insurance, kind of?
I see what you're saying. I'm a big free market guy, so I'm going to sure. go ahead and say no based on that philosophy. However, it already is required, and if you look at it from a slightly different perspective, and that's, you know, looking at it through the Medicaid lens, right?
Right.
Everybody has access to insurance. We're all paying into a system that ultimately pays a benefit or funds a system that you can access if you qualify for Medicaid. And granted, that's not something a lot of people are out there striving to do, because if you're familiar with Medicaid in California, Medi-Cal, you know, you have to pass an asset test, at least in 49 right. states, which we'll, I think we'll jump into in a second on that 50th state. But based on those 49, you got to spend down all of your assets to about $3,000, give or take. And that doesn't include the home or your car or a little weekly allowance. But generally, you know, you're impoverished if you qualify for Medicaid. And so that's something that, you know, I think a lot of people find is a good fallback. But I think it's worth mentioning here that it is a safety net. It was always intended to be a safety net for people who didn't have the means to take care of themselves in older age. And so that is really, I think, the outlook that I would share with people and give an example from my own personal history too. So my grandmother had Parkinson's for about 7 years when I was a kid. And this was something that, you know, we were not prepared for as a family. We had a disability insurance agency my parents ran. And actually my grandmother's husband had died earlier on, but he started the business. He started that disability insurance agency before long-term care was even, you know, a real consideration for the public. Mm-hmm. And so when she needed the care in the 90s, she spent down everything. She sold her house, you know, spent down literally to the last few thousand dollars. And the writing was on the wall. She was going to run out of money and was going to need to move into a Medi-Cal facility in my native California. And when that happened, as soon as she made the move, it was clearly a drop in care at the time. You know, not trying to cast a general, you know, feeling over how the Medi-Cal system works or the Medicaid system. But at the time,
you're absolutely
it was
right.
a clear drop in standard mm-hmm. of care. And as a child, going in there to visit grandma when she's quite literally on her deathbed and just having that smell, I'll never forget the smell. I'll never get that out of my head. Of walking into that facility and just being like, this place is disgusting and I'm never coming back, basically, is right. what my sister and I said to each other. And she died there within a couple of months because there was just something changed, right? I'm not going to call it a will to live or anything like that, but it was just clear that this was the end for her as soon as she made that change.
My grandfather had the exact same experience.
Oh, wow.
And he also divested in Georgia, was eligible and qualified for Medicaid in Georgia. I visited him two times in the facility. He was in two separate facilities. And he just, he was the most vibrant, full of life person. Mm. And when he went into the nursing facility, you could just tell that life just got sucked out of him, and he didn't want to be there. And he realized that there was no way that in that environment he could have gotten better.
Right.
But he just wished, I think, like, you know, towards the end, I remember some conversations that I had with him on the phone, and I knew that what he really wanted was just the chance to spend time with us, to be able to improve his quality of life. because these facilities that are funded by Medicaid, and I'm very familiar with Medicaid. We work with Medicaid in Tennessee all the time, so we know the struggles and challenges that they have. And we always push conversations towards long-term care insurance as much as we can. But yeah, I mean, their resources are stretched very thin, and the individuals that are working there are usually underpaid, and facilities are understaffed, and it's just difficult to manage that long-term care. I do want to talk more about Medicaid, but before we do, I just want to interject on something that I think would be very helpful for people that are listening and watching. In your opinion, how can we start having these conversations about, you know, getting long-term care insurance and even considering a care plan conversation? How can we start having those conversations a little bit earlier?
I think, in my opinion, it all stems from the understanding of retirement income. And I think that's a little bit of a different flavor than a lot of insurance planners take on this. Mm-hmm. But I think once you understand what your nest egg looks like and everything that you're working towards in your career to develop this nest egg so that you can finally take a break from working and have some passive income and just enjoy life as a retiree, if that's still the goal for you, then understanding and identifying that number and what that income support looks like from that number is really fundamental to determining how much long-term care insurance you're going to need. Because if you're trying to save, you know, and I like to just use the 4% rule as sort of a quick and easy math withdrawal rate from your nest egg. So again, you know, using that $10 million example, that would be a nice one, right? You've got $400,000, which is 4% of $10 million that you can take out per year. So that's really the goal, right? And then if it's $5 million, cut that in half. So you're looking at $200,000. If it's $2.5 million, you're looking at $100,000 of income. Mm-hmm. So that's really, I think people need to have a better understanding of that. And then once they determine that, okay, that $100,000 a year is really what I need to survive. Okay, well, what does that look like monthly? That's $8,300 a month, taxable. In many cases, a large part of that asset's going to be taxable, I think, for most people, unless it's all in a Roth or cash value or something like that. But generally speaking, it's going to, a significant portion of that's going to be taxable. And then from there, how much of that and Social Security, another key factor to understand in this equation, at pension too, if that's part of, you know, the government, usually government, hard to find in the private sector these days. But you know, calculate the Social Security, calculate the pension, calculate that retirement income from the expected or projected nest egg, and then determine what the cost of care is going to be. So these are the steps that I like to take because, you know, we talk a lot about the question of self-insurance, which is a misnomer. And I'll credit the great Bill Comfort on that line because he loves to really underscore that because insurance is a spread of risk among right. other people. You're not self-insuring anything because what you're really doing is self-funding. Anyway, a little aside for Bill.
We love Bill.
He's great. So but if you're going to be self-funding, you know, you don't necessarily need to self-fund the full amount. And conversely, you don't need to fully insure the entire care experience. You know, there's a lot of gray area. It's not option one or option two. There's a huge 1.1, 1.2, 1.3, 1.4, and so on, that's in between. And we just need to determine how much of that can we self-fund? How much of a gap are we looking at? And how much would we like to have that will help us not have to worry about that gap? Because that's another consideration right. that a lot of risk-averse people are going to want to take.
And especially if you're an individual who's going to retire with, you know, $1, $2, $3, $4, $5 million, $10 million, so just to put into perspective, just some quick math, you know, you do on the back of a napkin, you know, if you consider home care, depending on what type of health outcomes, what type of health conditions or diagnoses that you might have, very easily could it be possible for you to require 8 hours of care a day? You know, and if you consider 8 hours of care a day in a major market, like say, for example, Miami, you're going to be paying an individual at least $25 an hour. If you want them to be dependable, reliable, perform at a high level, you know, somebody that's committed to further education, you know, because obviously these types of disabilities are constantly evolving. And I mean, consider that $25 an hour for an 8 hour day. That's $200 a day. That's your entire monthly premium in one day, you know, and that's, and honestly, 8 hours a day, 5 days a week is somebody that has a physical disability, somebody that may have just, you know, had a significant injury, like a fall that resulted in a surgery, like a hip replacement, which is very common, or a knee replacement. You know, if you've suffered from a stroke, which happens all the time, if you have any type of paralysis in any extremity of your body, like everybody thinks like, this is crazy. No, it happens every single day. And it's so expensive. And you could have literally spent $200 a month before any type of significant severe medical event occurred to insure yourself so that you had at least a $200 a day benefit that was paid out to you to cover the costs. So I think I love the quantifiable perspective that you take from the perspective of retirement. I take the same quantifiable aspect just from the cost of care and humanize it. And so, yeah, man, I like this. This is going
good. Yeah. No, it's what you're bringing in is so important for people to understand, because, you know, you see these expenses just shoot off the page in today's dollars.
Yeah.
And then you factor in, we're talking about an event that potentially could be 20, 30 years down the road. And so how does inflation play into all that? Well, we know about healthcare inflation and how it usually outpaces normal inflation, and everyone's pulling their hair out about normal inflation right now. So just exponentiate that, I guess, is really my, you know, without getting too into the dollars and cents of it, you know, you can basically double it in 25 years, right?
Conservative 3%. Absolutely. And at the cost of care in a small community in the middle of Tennessee has gone from about $15 an hour in 2012 to let me rephrase that. That was the cost that for me to pay somebody. It went to $25 an hour. If you extrapolate that into what a person ends up paying for it, they're paying anywhere around $32 an hour in a small town like Tennessee. If some of the major markets that I've looked into over the course of even the last 4 years are closer to the $40 range. If you look at like New York, LA. And so it's really hard to self-fund this, like extremely hard. And when we talk about long-term care insurance, it's just something that I'm so passionate about, because nobody wants to listen to me whenever I say it until it's too late. And then it's like, well, did you get long-term care insurance? No, I literally just had this conversation with my father-in-law, who's 72, whose brother is suffering from a cognitive disability. And it's just like, no one wants to talk about the fact that he's cognitively he's having early onset, you know, most likely early onset Alzheimer's. But at the same time, no one wants to address the fact that he has this disability. And also nobody wants to address the fact that they don't have long-term care insurance. But I told him, I said, at this point, he's probably not going to get approved for a long-term care insurance policy. And so as we're talking, and I just literally had this conversation a day ago, it's so relative to everything that we're discussing right now. And it's happening in our own families every single day. All right, moving on. Sorry, I had to get on that soapbox for a second there.
That's great.
How will changing enrollment qualifications for Medicaid programs like Medi-Cal impact the need for long-term care insurance?
I think, you say impact. I think, I don't know if it's one of those words that's a homophone. Does that mean, is that a double meaning? Mm-hmm. But you talk about
homonym.
Thank you. Yeah. Homonym. Word guy doesn't know the word.
It's all good.
If you're talking about impact, like in how it affects things, and also impactedness. I think, you know, we're looking at both versions of that word here. You know, Medi-Cal specifically. So as a primer for our informed audience, Medicaid is known as Medicaid in 49 states. Mm-hmm. In California, it's known as Medi-Cal. So just remember that through this discussion. And also in 49 states, you are required to be impoverished. And I think I mentioned this earlier, yep, down to about $3,000 in assets to qualify for Medicaid.
Right.
But in my native California, they are expanding the eligibility requirements by completely eliminating the asset test next year. So January 1, let me spell that out for you.
That is wild.
I'm from Marin County. It's just across the Golden Gate Bridge from San Francisco. It's one of the most beautiful places on earth, truly, without question. Mm-hmm. Do you happen to know the average home price in Marin County, Costa?
Can I guess?
Take a guess.
Okay.
Take a guess.
$1 million?
Pretty close. It's 1.466 million.
Wow.
And that's down 6% this year.
Okay.
So Marin has had a high percentage of affluence, but also a super high percentage of older people compared to the rest of the state, and certainly compared to the United States. Mm-hmm. On top of that, it's also got a high cost of living. So one thing that I think a lot of people miss about California, which is, you know, it's got this reputation as being this high tax state, property taxes are actually locked in at the time of purchase. So if you bought a little bungalow in Tiburon in 1976 for $200,000, and now it's worth $2 million, and your property tax is pegged in, locked in at $2,000 a year, 1% of that original purchase price, are you liquidating that asset and moving anytime soon? Absolutely not. Not into a townhome worth $1.1 million and it's over $10,000 in taxes, right? Mm-hmm. People are super house rich and cash poor in Marin. And this is just kind of a representative place it's a little unique in certain facets, but it is pretty representative of California in general.
Fascinating. High
property prices. So even though they're sitting on these massive assets, they can now sell their assets, right? And keep them. So they can sell that $2 million house, put that $2 million in the bank, and still go into a Medi-Cal facility. So those factors, they all result in probably a lot of people who are sitting on a huge asset and have access to this new system. And that would be great if Medi-Cal had the capacity. See, I'm not against Medi-Cal in the big safety net. I think that's great for people in need.
It's not feasible, though.
It's just a math problem.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
There's just the math doesn't work.
I know.
As far as I can see.
And
so, yeah.
No. Go ahead. Finish your thought, please.
Well, I was just going to cap it off by reminding people, you know, our informed listeners here, that there is this silver tsunami approaching too, right? So you've got the oldest baby boomers. How old are they? They're about to turn 80 in a couple of years. So what comes next is just going to distress the system. There's never been a more important time for owning private long-term care insurance in California, in my opinion.
Absolutely. And here's the thing. Medi-Cal, as we addressed earlier, and Medicaid in general, they don't reimburse providers from a value-based perspective. So they're not saying, give me the highest quality of service and I will reimburse you for that service that you're providing. No, they're saying like, hey, just like every other state, all 50 states, the largest budget line item in each state budget is their Medicaid program. So they're like, already it's the most expensive part. We have to figure out a way to keep this cost effective so they keep prices down or cost down, reimbursement down, which means that usually the individuals in these facilities are underpaid. And it's difficult to take care of anybody else when you can't take care of yourself. You know, I say that on the show often. So while very well people are going to have access to long-term care because it's in inevitability, I think people have to remember that, and they're going to access this Medicaid marketplace, they're going to realize that the outcomes that they were looking for are not there. Health outcomes, quality of care outcomes, quality of service outcomes. So what ends up happening is the family has to then fill in all of the gaps. And so if you don't have long-term care insurance, what you're missing is control. Control of how you receive care, where you receive care, when you receive care, and by whom. Okay. So if you have the ability to buy a policy early in life and you need to access the long-term care marketplace, you can do it on your terms. Even though Medicaid is free, right? Relative. You don't have control of where you're going to go because the companies or the providers that are going to cater to the non-Medicaid market are going to be even more expensive now because the demand is going to get even higher, right? So these are all things to consider. I will say from a feasibility standpoint, and I know we're getting a little technical here, maybe a little bit off topic, but I have to say it since we're on the topic of it. There is absolutely no way that Medicaid can absorb the amount of people in California that will need these services. When we're talking about 70% of people needing long-term care after the age of 75, first baby boomer just turned 75 in 2021. Like, we're on the roller coaster getting to the top. You know, it's not slowing down, right? And so we are, I mean, the cost overruns are huge. There's a reason, folks, for anybody that's watching, there's a reason why Medicare does not want to pick up the long-term care bill. They don't want to create a public option for long-term care as you see it whenever you turn 65 and you get Medicare. It's because they can't afford it. So,
and they quite seriously looked at it.
They
too.
Did.
It was part of the Affordable Care Act in 2009, right? So, you know, they did the feasibility study. They said adverse selection was a serious issue in the way that the law was structured, and they pulled it off the shelf after it had been passed. So it tells you a lot about the real need for this stuff and how we can fund it or not fund it.
Before we wrap up, though, I do want to ask you just one quick thing. Let's say somebody watches this video and they're like, these guys are crazy. Let's just, you know, like sometimes when you talk to your financial advisors and they're like, you're crazy. Like, I'm not going to talk to my clients about this. They don't need it. They're going to self-fund. What does that actually look like? And realistically, what percentage of people can actually afford to self-insure?
Oh boy. Yeah. Percentage of people, I don't know. I'd be best guessing there. You know, it would probably be less than 5%.
Of the U.S. population.
Of the U.S. population, less than 5%.
It's accurate.
Safely, right? Yeah. Safely, with running the Monte Carlos, all the simulations, you know, and being able to absorb that, it's, you know, less than 5%. Maybe probably even less than that. But you know, you've got a lot of people who are going to try to make it work, right? And so, even understanding, you know, what that looks like, even for just the next 5%, you know, the highest 10% of savings, people who have the highest 10% of savings or income in retirement, you know, they're going to probably try to self-insure, right? I mean, more than that are going to self-insure. We know that,
right?
You know, just by looking at the whole distribution of this marketplace, I think we're still stuck at that 10% penetration number or less.
Seven.
Oh my God, it's dropped. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're in trouble. So it just comes down to, you know, you're looking at 93% of people either self-insuring or using some sort of government assistance. And
right.
Those, you know, maybe you say the bottom, let's just call it the bottom 50% are going to use some sort of government assistance.
Yep.
Well, you still got, what is that, 43%? That are going to be self-insuring. Those are the folks we need to be striking these conversations with. Be very self-aware. You know, I think who was it who said, Americans are not socialists because they're all just embarrassed millionaires, temporarily embarrassed millionaires. I think that was a Steinbeck quote.
Okay.
Steinbeck.
I like it.
And so, you know, have some self-awareness, right? Like understand that, you know, you're not going to hit the lotto.
Right.
It's not going to happen quite the way that maybe you've been hoping for your entire 50-year career. If you've been working that long, it's going to be something that you need to plan for. And, you know, it doesn't have to be full insurance. You know, you don't need to wholly 100% insure your long-term care scenario, but understand what the math is behind it.
Yeah.
You know, deduct from the Social Security amount that you're expecting. First, figure that out, right? Secondly, figure out what your retirement income looks like. And then do the math, do it, you know, do it smartly, work with somebody who can help you intelligently. And you know, a financial advisor can do that, an insurance broker who specializes in long-term care could go a long way with that too.
And that 43% of people that you're talking about, those are all middle-income Americans. I mean, not all, but the majority of them, I'd say probably 35% of the 43. And so like, those are people who have worked their entire lives, have built a career, have raised, you know, raised a family or, you know, essentially worked in a professional environment. Maybe even had a small business, like that are going to retire in some capacity with that $200,000 to $300,000, maybe $500,000, but under $1 million. And those are the people that should be getting this insurance more than anybody else. You know, like y'all, you're going to have to divest all your resources, qualify for Medicaid, then get your long-term care paid for, average stay in a facility, just average utilization of long-term care is 3.2 years. So if on average long-term care costs anywhere between $40,000 and $125,000, you're going to spend a lot of money on it. And it may be all of your money. So just hedge, you know, just hedge by buying a policy. And it, like you were saying, doesn't have to be $200. It could be, you know, maybe $50 or $100 a month, you know, something. And, you know, obviously I think the elephant in the room is, you've got to exercise and you've got to take care of your body and you've got to make sure that you're not one of, you know, the one and two that are considered overweight or morbidly obese, because that leads to adverse health outcomes. Like, those are all things that you have to do to make sure that you may never even have to use your policy, you know? So we always, it's exactly, we always like to end the show with a call to action. Let's say you're 55 years old, in good health, and you have no protection for your finances or future. What would you do today to begin the process of protecting your livelihood and family?
It's simple for me. It would be to start to understand, start to build a framework. And the first step of that is determining what your projected Social Security benefit is going to look like. Identify, if you haven't done it already and you're 55, you got to know your number. You got to know what it's going to take to get to retirement across that finish line. Figure that out and just use the 4% rule. You don't have to get too crazy with the analysis. Identify what your retirement income looks like between Social Security and that 4% distribution. And then understand what the cost of care is, and then figure out how much of a gap there is for you and what that projection looks like. And then go call Costa or call somebody to make sure that you're addressing the long-term care risk.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Now or Never, Long-Term Care Strategy with Costa Yepafonsif. If you enjoyed listening and you want to hear more, make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Leave us a review, or better yet, share this episode with a friend. Now or Never Long-Term Care Strategy with Costa Yepafonsif is a Costa Yepafonsif production. Today's episode was written and produced by Morgan Franklin, production assistance by Mike Franklin. Want to find out more about Costa? Visit us at costayepafonsif.com.